Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the politics of petulance as the man-child and leader of the free world blows up alliances and tramples on relations with traditional allies while reaching out to rehabilitate Russia and reward China as our president forges a radical global realignment with despots and kleptocrats, with Trump, like a godfather meeting with fellow mob bosses to carve up territory, announcing that we've got a world to run. Thomas Nichols, a professor of national security affairs at the Naval War College, whose latest book is The Death of Expertise, The Campaign Against Established Knowledge and Why It Matters, joins us to discuss the extraordinary inversion of national security priorities as Trump embraces enemies and trashes allies with an insulting attack on America's closest neighbor and ally, Canada, at the same time elevating one of the world's worst dictators with praise and prestige. We will look into Trump's childish reversal over an imaginary slight by Canada's prime minister, who Trump gratuitously demeaned, rejecting a consensus reached at the G7. And the unreal nature of the reality TV summit about to take place in Singapore, where the theatrics of an easy deal with a do-over dictator is about to be sold as great global statesmanship. Then we'll explore the now obvious hold that Vladimir Putin has over Donald Trump, with Trump's own director of national intelligence at a meeting in France warning that Putin is trying to divide the NATO alliance, while at the same time Trump calls for Putin's readmission to the G7 at a testy meeting in Quebec at which the British Prime Minister was hoping to get a unanimous condemnation of Russia for their nerve gas attack on British soil. Roger Morris, who served on the National Security Council under both Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon until resigning with Anthony Lake over the bombing of Cambodia, whose latest book is The Comparative History of the U.S. and the USSR, Kindred Rivals, America, Russia, and Their Failed Ideals, joins us to discuss the disturbing possibility that our president is Putin's puppet. And then finally, we'll speak with Stephen Kinzer, who served as the New York Times bureau chief in Nicaragua and is a senior fellow at the Watson Institute for International Public Affairs at Brown University, about his article at the Boston Globe, Nicaragua on the Brink of Calamity. He joins us to discuss how, for the second time in many generations, Nicaraguans are rebelling against a decadent family regime and efforts by the Catholic bishops to get the authoritarian leader Daniel Ortega to stop shooting down peaceful protesters and agree to a new election. And joining us now is Thomas Nichols, a professor of national security affairs in the National Security Decision-Making Department at the Naval War College, where he's also the course director for Security Strategy and Forces. He previously taught international relations and Soviet-Russia affairs at Dartmouth College and Georgetown University. And his latest book is The Death of Expertise, The Campaign Against Established Knowledge and Why It Matters. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thomas Nichols.
Good to be with you, Ian.
Well, thank you, Thomas. And given my introduction, I'm sure you want to make the disclaimer that you're speaking as a private individual, not on behalf of the United States Navy.
Of course, absolutely.
Okay. So in the spirit of being fair and balanced, let's try and figure out what's going on here, because frankly, I am absolutely dumbfounded. I cannot believe that we are subject to such petulant whims and childish protestations where the entire architecture of post-war alliances, the rule of law, a rules-based international system are now under active threat, while it appears that the worst players on the international stage have already been rewarded, if not dignified.
Well, you had to see this coming. I mean, this is completely consistent with how the president ran his campaign, playing to all of these imaginary American grievances, this notion that, you know, America is this victim nation that we're taken advantage of by all of these kind of slick intellectual players all around the world that are somehow hijacking our national wealth in a corrupt trade system. There are two wrinkles to this that I think are really important. One is the completely supine position of the Republican leadership in Congress, which wants nothing to do with restraining him. Senator Corker actually thought at one point about to introduce legislation to rein in the president's mania for tariffs. Mitch McConnell stomped all over that. So Republicans in Congress, they know where their bread is buttered. They're getting their tax cuts. They're getting other things they want out of the Trump administration. And they're simply not going to do anything to defend the global order. The second wrinkle, I think, is how afraid of Vladimir Putin the president really is. He takes every possible opportunity to try to get on his good side, to send a message that he really, you know, wants to be a friend to Russia. And, you know, this attack on the G7 has to be making Putin smile. I mean, this is, this divorcing of the United States from Europe, from Canada, from the G7, from NATO, these are all long-held Russian goals. And I don't think that Putin's doing it because they're Russian goals. I think Trump's doing it because they're Russian goals. I think Trump's doing it because he finds it easier to pick fights with friends than enemies.
Well, I think when you have to deal with friends, you have to deal on the basis of consensus with reason and rationality and knowledge seriousness. Where the whole point is that rehabilitating pariahs is easy, isn't it? I mean, these guys like Putin and Kim Jong-un are desperate to be rehabilitated and, recognized.
Except that Trump's not doing anything that opens a path to rehabilitation. He's simply preemptively conceding everything and allowing them to be who they are, to do what they've been doing, and to go on the path they've been on without really demanding anything of them. I mean, this is kind of classic bullying behavior that you lash out at the people that are closest to you, almost kind of the way that, you know, you'd pick on your own family because they sort of have to forgive you, whereas, as is the case in, with all kinds of bullying behavior, you really fear the other bullies on the playground. You don't really want to get into a fight with the toughest guy in the yard. And so Trump picks easy targets. I mean, he goes after the Canadians. He goes after the Brits. He goes after the G7, while never daring to pick a fight with Putin or with Kim Jong-un or with President Xi of China, whom he's referred to as a wonderful guy. I don't think there's any mystery psychologically about why the president does this, but it's incredibly destructive to American foreign policy.
Well, in the opening, I made the analogy with The Godfather, and that does appear to be the kind of attitude that Trump, as he was leaving for the G7, he said, you know, we've got a world to run. This is after he had talked about wanting to bring Russia back into the G7, and that came out of nowhere, and apparently that was not cleared with, or none of his advisors knew he was going to say that. And there's no question, I think, by doing that before the G7, he completely undercut Prime Minister Theresa May, who apparently he refers to as a schoolmarm. Her efforts to bring about a consensus in condemning Russia for the nerve gas attack on British soil. So it certainly seemed to have had a purpose there, but the attitude, we've got a world to run. It felt like the Godfather sitting down with the various Godfathers, you know, you get the West Side, I get the East Side, you get the North Side, I get the South Side. Is that what we're heading towards?
I don't think so. I think that's how Trump, how the president wants to be perceived. The problem is that when he goes trotting after Putin like this, he's really putting himself in the position of the junior partner. And I think the Godfather analogy, which a lot of people have used, is really flawed, because if you've seen the movie, you know, the Godfather himself, Don Corleone, is actually quite prudent. He's physically quite courageous. He's very judicious. He picks his friends and his enemies very carefully. That's not this. This is kind of, I mean, if you're really going to make the Godfather analogy, this is sort of like a dumber, more emotional Sonny in charge of everything, just lashing out in every direction and telling, you know, telling Tom Hagen, his consigliere, no more talk, no more lawyers. This isn't really the Godfather so much as it is kind of a Goodfellas or, you know, the last days of John Gotti or something. This is not actually somebody who's capable of entering into that kind of condominium with the Russians, I think.
Right, or it could be even worse in terms of the family and Godfather family analogy. It could be Fredo. And again, I'm speaking with Thomas Nichols, a professor of national security affairs in the National Security Division Making Department at the Naval War College, where he's also the course director for security strategy and forces. He previously taught international relations and Soviet-Russian affairs at Dartmouth College and Georgetown University. And his latest book is The Death of Expertise, The Campaign Against Established Knowledge and Why It Matters. So in terms of these phony kind of populist issues that Trump is throwing out, and in many ways, I think the sanctions against Canada for steel and aluminum are entirely based upon hoping to win the Rust Belt in 2020. As otherwise, it doesn't make any sense. And when he talks about WSICA being the piggy bank, again, he's playing to an old canard that Americans think that they are the most generous nation on the earth, when in fact their per capita in terms of foreign aid is quite low, and they're not being taken advantage of. But I think the point you made earlier is, you know, when you talked about the cravenness of the Republican establishment, surely they're responding to the fact that Donald Trump, its popularity amongst Republicans is at an all-time high. It may actually be a record.
Sure. And, you know, the other wise move, I think, you see this particularly if you look at somebody like Senator McConnell, is they're just keeping their heads down. They're saying, you know, let him run, let him do the things he's going to do. We'll kind of clean up the mess later. We'll figure out how to deal with it. In a way, you almost have to admire how unbelievably disciplined McConnell is. If you go all the way back to the campaign and he said, look, I support the Republican nominee and I'm not going to say any more about it. And he got away with that. He just didn't say anything more about it. Whereas Paul Ryan would try to get out there and he'd say, well, I don't like that Trump said this, but I try to support the nominee. And he'd go back and forth. And he took a lot of static for that. So I think Republicans have figured out that there's a kind of 35% to 40% of their base that will come out in primaries and make their lives difficult. And it's easier to just let them all howl into the wind, let Trump, do the things he's going to do, and then fix it later when nobody's looking. Unfortunately, that doesn't help you mend alliances or restore American leadership in the world.
Well, that's, I think, where there's a more serious portent of trouble ahead. We've been worried about the possibility of a trade war breaking out, and that's bad enough on its own. But if you look at the response after Trump did a U-turn and withdrew from the consensus final statement at the G7 in Quebec, and of course he left a day earlier because the agenda was going to be discussing climate change. And he'd already pulled out of Paris, as we all know. But the Élysée Palace, the French statement is, international cooperation can't depend on anger and small words. Let's be serious and worthy of our people. We spent 2 days obtaining a draft and commitments. We stick to it. And anyone who leaves and turns their back on them shows their inconsistency. And the German foreign minister says it's actually not a real surprise. We have seen this with the climate agreement or the Iran deal. In a matter of seconds, you can destroy trust with 280 Twitter characters. To build that up again will take much longer. So my sense is that this is where the real damage may be being done. And as you pointed out earlier, Thomas Nichols, the person who is winning in this exchange, this in effect geopolitical suicide pact that Trump is engaged in, is Vladimir Putin.
Yeah, and I think what's really damaging us among the Europeans is not that the president is saying these things, because Trump was not an unknown quantity. They know him. He's been around for 30 years. I think early on, though, the Europeans were counting on cooler heads prevailing. So while the president's going to say all this, but that there are going to be sensible people and professionals and experts that are going to run things and, kind of save him from himself. And that's not happening. I mean, he's gotten rid of all those people. The White House is increasingly filled with second and third string figures. And the public, at least, as you pointed out, a significant part of the Republican Party supports him. So I think the Europeans are saying, this isn't just a one-off. Maybe the Americans really have kind of lost their minds for a while and they're just going to be out of the game. And that definitely rebounds to the advantage of Vladimir Putin, who can then turn to them and say, look, I know you're your heart is with the Americans, but the Americans have gone off the rails, and I'm not that much worse than they are, so maybe, you know, we can talk. And that I think, leads to all kinds of bad effects down the line, including potentially an economic or a military crisis, because the world isn't going to run without the United States. And I think that the president's been very lucky that he hasn't been tested by a real crisis yet. But I think one's coming, and it's going to be pretty scary when it does.
And while Donald Trump is blowing up the G7 in Quebec, Vladimir Putin and Xi Jinping were in China toasting the expansion of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. And, of course, again, self-inflicted wounds, pulling out of TPP, the Paris Accords, blowing up the Iran deal. It's been nothing but gifts to China or to Russia, or it's an extraordinary record so far of wreckage. And again, you keep asking yourself, well, what's the purpose here? What's the point? Is there anything constructive? I mean, you look to the, I know I'm pretty cynical about the Singapore. Obviously, one doesn't want a nuclear war on the Korean Peninsula. It'd be great to have a peace treaty and end that confrontation. But I don't see any substance to this. Do you? I mean, I can't for the life of me.
No, there isn't. And I think if you really want to understand the president and his supporters, you have to stop looking for rational reasons, and you have to start thinking about deep emotional resentment. You can pretty much get this administration to do something by saying that a bunch of smart people think you shouldn't do it. That's almost enough for this administration to just plow ahead and do it. You know, a lot of smart people in a lot of capitals of the world think a trade war would be bad. Okay, good. Let's do that because it'll annoy them. You know, it's purely symbolic to pull out of the Paris Accords, but the New York Times won't like it, so let's do it. You know, a lot of foreign policy experts don't think you should go to Singapore. Well, that's why I'm going to go to Singapore. There's almost like an oppositional defiance disorder in the administration that looks for kind of the most intelligent opinions it can find and then tries to do the opposite of them, because that was a big part of how Trump sold himself on the campaign trail. So it's just Trump emotionally connecting with his base voters over and over and over again for no real reason other than the kind of instant emotional charge of a lot of negative headlines. I really think we do ourselves a disservice here by trying to unpack this into some sort of rational policy. There isn't any policy here.
Right, but the worst thing we can do is to do what Hillary Clinton did, which is to play into that by talking about a basket full of deplorables. What, in fact, do we do if we're in the rational universe and Trump's people are in the Fox News alternative facts universe? Is there a way to bridge that gap?
No. I mean, I wish I could be more optimistic, but the answer to that question is no. There is no way to bridge that gap. And I think I wrote a only mildly tongue-in-cheek piece where I said, you know, if Trump really wants a trade war, maybe the best thing we can do is to have one and to let there actually people experience the suffering that comes from high tariffs and a trade war. Now, I realize that, you know, innocent people would suffer from that. But it may be that the only way to get people to understand how bad these policies are is to actually enact a few of them and let people live with the consequences. But I'm not sure even that would do it, because they would blame the elites, the media, the Democrats, you know, whoever the scapegoat of the moment is. But I think that the only answer to this lies with the voters, that, you know, this is just the way things are going to be until 2018, if and when the Democrats take the House. And then in 2020, I think, yes, I take your point about, you know, Hillary Clinton was just a bad candidate. I mean, that was just a dumb thing to say out loud. But I think that there's also the other mistake of trying to negotiate half a loaf with people who don't actually have fixed policy preferences and will change their mind at the drop of a hat simply because the president tweeted something at 5 a.m.
Well, we'll see. I mean, whether destroying the Affordable Care Act and getting rid of coverage for pre-existing conditions, you'd think that maybe that might resonate, but I guess we have to hold our breath and wait till November. I thank you for joining us, Thomas Nichols. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Thomas Nichols. He's professor of national security affairs in the National Security Decision-Making Department at the Naval War College, where he's also the course director for security strategy and forces. He previously taught international relations and Soviet-Russian affairs at Dartmouth College and Georgetown University. And his latest book is The Death of Expertise, The Campaign Against Established Knowledge and Why It Matters. We're going to take a brief station break and back exploring the now obvious hold that Vladimir Putin has over Donald Trump.
He's a real nowhere man, sitting in his nowhere land, making all his nowhere plans for nobody. Doesn't have a point of view, knows not where he's going to. Isn't he a bit like you?
From Russia with love I fly to you, much wiser since my goodbye to you.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Roger Morris, who served in the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Council under both Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon, until resigning with Anthony Lake over the invasion of Cambodia. He is the author of Between the Graves, America, Afghanistan, and the Politics of Intervention, which is based on thousands of previously secret documents. And his latest book is A Comparative History of the Inner Politics of the U.S. and the USSR, Kindred Rivals, America, Russia, and Their Failed Ideals. Welcome to Background Briefing, Roger Morris.
Thank you, Ian.
And Roger, is there any way to kind of get your head around the extraordinary phenomenon of watching the President of the United States trample on longstanding alliances while rewarding despots and kleptocrats? I was talking to the previous guest, as it feels like when Donald Trump, of course, heading off to the G7, said, "We got a world to run." That struck me as like the Godfather meeting with fellow mob bosses to carve up the territory. He seems much more comfortable with Putin's and the Kim Jong-un's of the world and the Xi Jinping's than the Merkel's, Macron's, and our nice, friendly Canadians next door.
you mean the weak and dishonest Canadians next door? You know, I was reminded of a fateful moment just a few weeks before the February 1917 Russian Revolution. It's in the Duma, which was still functioning then under the old Tsarist regime, and a leader of the Constitutional Democrats, the sort of middle of the road bourgeois party, named Paul Milyukov, rose to make a speech, once again criticizing the government, and he included a phrase which was to ring down the years in Russian history, and which was really quite provocative and instrumental in sparking the February Revolution that overthrew the Tsarist regime. He asked his colleagues, reciting again and again the folly and the utter blundering of the government against the interests of Russian national security and the interests of its people. He said, "Is this stupidity or is it treason?" And the question of stupidity or treason, I think, is all too relevant with Donald Trump. I think, Ian, without exaggeration, and you and I, as you know, go back for years and years, we've seen a lot of folly and utter disaster in Washington. I think this bids to be the darkest moment in recent American history in terms of its impact, both in foreign policy and in domestic affairs. Whether Donald Trump is the captive of a hostile Russian regime, whether he's being blackmailed into this, or whether he is following
some kind of enormously stupid and ill-informed course of his own in foreign policy really in the end doesn't make much difference in terms of its effect. As you know, Susan Rice wrote a thoughtful piece in the New York Times the other day saying it doesn't matter whether Vladimir Putin is directing things behind the scenes or not. The behavior of the regime is very much in his interest. The compromise of the American government and the damage that's done to our alliances abroad. It's the worst moment in American foreign policy in terms of our relationship with allies in memory. We haven't had such a moment until the criticism of the United States by the British and the French on the eve of World War II, when we were not yet in any alliance with them. But since World War II, that's a long time, since World War II, we have never been so criticized, so by allies, so at odds with our common national interests. And never since then has the American system of alliances, which we worked so long and hard to foster, been so endangered. So I think this is an extremely dark moment, and it's a dark moment not only because you have a psychopath in the Oval Office, whether he's compromised or not, but also because you have an utterly derelict national government, unable in its Republican majority to challenge this psychopathic behavior, but also among the Democrats, who I think still remain, despite their resurgence at the grassroots, still remain in its national leadership a derelict party themselves. So I've never been so pessimistic about the American position in the world.
Well, it's one thing to be stupid, and I think Trump is stupid like a fox. I mean, he's got everybody on the defensive. He's so brash and brazen, and you don't know whether he's deliberately lying cynically or he just believes stupid stuff. For example, his attack on Prime Minister Trudeau of Canada is based upon a complete lie. He said, you know, your tariffs 270% on dairy. You know, you're taking us to the cleaners. You know, we're the piggy bank and you're robbing us. Well, it turns out that the Canadians import five times more dairy products from the United States than they export to the United States. It's just on every turn and twist of these taunts and tweets and being whipsawed in this deliberate way to I call it government by stunt, you know, or rule by spectacle, as Tim Snyder refers to it. We're all being sort of manipulated in this way. So let's deal with, since I guess there's no, you know, you have to get a shrink to figure that one out. But let's deal with the other possibility, treason. That seems to me to be more and more logical. And I think the problem we have is simply it's very hard for the average American to get their head around the idea that the President of the United States is actually being was put there by a hostile foreign power who's able to get him. I don't believe there's any ongoing collusion. You don't have to collude if this person is, you know, a Polizny Durak, a useful idiot, which is what he appears to be.
Well, and part of the psychopathic dimension to all of this, Ian, is that he doesn't really see anything wrong with that manipulation and subversion, that suborning of the electoral process by the Russians, because it installs him, and he, I think there is an elaborate and permanent sense of entitlement here, of the justification of his rule. So that he was aided and abetted or blackmailed or in any sense influenced by a foreign power and is still in power in the United States, I think all of the distinctions that we would draw between stupidity and treason and between right and wrong are absolutely blurred, if not obliterated, by Donald Trump. I mean, we literally have here, whether his madness is purposeful or not to some extent, whether he has some kind of strategy that he found useful in New York real estate. We still have a madman here, and a madman commands attention, commands certainly respect in the sense of you're trying to limit the damage that he does, and the damage is all too real. As I said earlier, I think his motives, the exact mix of this psychopathic dimension in the man, the exact mix of the absolutely cowardly and unprincipled, really unparalleled behavior of the Republican Congress, that constitutes in its own way a kind of treason. A treason of neglect, a treason of expedience, a treason of complicity for the purposes of personal power. So, I just think that this is a very, very dark moment, and I agree with your previous guest. I think there's no ready answer to this. The electoral process will play itself out in November, but that will be at best only a partial solution. Even if the Democrats should take both the Senate and the House, it's by no means clear that an impeachment process would be successful. I think that the only true answer is 2020, and again I'm frightened to death at the prospect of this Democratic Party as we now know it in its upper echelons. Really, for that matter, being able to defeat Donald Trump in 2020. I think this is going to be a much closer-run national crisis than we have imagined.
Well, since you're a student of the Soviet Union and Russia, Roger, going way back to going to Moscow University as a young Fulbright student, my sense is that there's a the leadership of the Democratic Party is a little bit like the Soviet Politburo in the way that they're clinging on to power for the sake of power. Just to go back to the Yale historian Timothy Snyder's analysis, that you can't separate Trump from the idea of a wannabe oligarch, that he's always wanted to be and touted himself as the billionaire that he's not. But because of the abuse of emoluments, he will probably end up as a billionaire using the White House as his new real estate shingle. But
no question, he's already a world-class kleptocrat by any standard. And I think that will only increase. I think you have a family empire that is building a web of contacts that we don't even know all about yet. I think there's no question that they will exploit every opportunity, every inch of space they've got in the federal government. And an oligarch, yes, and he's not aspiring to it. He already is to a large extent. I mean, his takeover of the Republican Party, again, by the sheer cowardice and fear and ignorance of that Republican political class in Congress, is already nearly complete. And his hold on whatever it may be, 25, 30, 35%, this core of know-nothing Republican voters is really decisive. You have here, Ian, a functioning tyranny of the minority. And you're talking about the old Soviet Union, yes, there are certainly Brezhnevs and Kosygins and others in the Democratic Party, but the system at large resembles that tyranny of the minority, and that's what we have. We have a minority of voters, we have a minority of political consciousness, and that has not yet been. It's been attacked. It's been shaken to some extent. It's been annoyed by the media, but it certainly hasn't yet effectively been challenged. And we'll have to hope for the best in 2018. Perhaps decisive Democratic majorities in both the House and the Senate, which I just don't see happening. could effectively challenge that power. And we've got Robert Mueller and of course the unknown factor of what he may find. But again, I think it's going to be close run, because as you well know, you pointed out again and again, those findings will certainly be challenged by the Know Nothing core of Trump voters. It'll be challenged by, it's already being challenged by Trump, and that challenge will be largely acquiesced in by the Republicans in Congress.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, my sense is that Mueller, I mean, and I know you've got good connections with former U.S. and Russian intelligence people. And what I'm hearing is that in terms of the oligarch mentality of Trump, the wannabe oligarch, the key is that meeting that took place at the Nobu restaurant in Moscow in November of 2013, where Trump was basically with the number of top oligarchs. Putin was supposed to come, but had a diplomatic reception he had to go to. But at that meeting, they inculcated in him a whole game plan, a mindset, an invitation to become one of them, to be financed by them, to become president, to run the world according to them. Which is what's happening now, this idea of the Godfathers carving up all the territory. And, you know, as soon as he goes back to the United States, what does he do? He starts this Bertha conspiracy, which in effect, because Putin hated Obama even more than he hated Hillary Clinton, which in effect, brought out Trump's base, this Know-Nothing base that you talked about. They were given permission to be racist again, and the rest is history. So that's my understanding. Do you think Mueller is going to be able to lay out that picture in the clearest possible terms so people will have that, oh, my God, moment? Yes, this guy was put in here by that little fellow over there in Moscow.
You know, I think this is perhaps the greatest single, I keep talking in superlatives here, but I really do feel that way, the greatest single challenge in American law enforcement and then later in jurisprudence that we have ever seen. I think Mueller has to take that leap, that absolutely huge leap from simply the enforcement of money laundering laws and even the emoluments clause and all the rest, to what you just described, to this larger conspiracy of a global kleptocracy, which enlists Russia and the United States and a number of other countries in the offing, and which would become the dominant force of the 21st century. And I think that struggle between a kleptocratic government and what will ultimately be dictatorship on a global scale, which we have never seen before, and what's left of the democratic liberal West is the struggle of our time. And Mueller really, this is not going to be easy. I mean, Mueller has a bunch of very talented, very gifted, but very conventional prosecutors and a very conventional FBI. And this is going to take an historical and historic leap of faith and of understanding for him to make that case and to make it in a political way that will reach enough, just your oh my God moment, as you described it, reach enough of that Trump base to dislodge him and his hold over the Republican Party. I don't think the Republican Party is entirely lost. It's just 90% gone, and it could recover. It could, out of its own self-interest, it could recover, and it must over time. But this is an absolutely make or break moment when Mueller comes forth with his findings, and then with the Democrats' response, and then with the Republicans. I mean, we've never seen anything like it, Ian.
Right.
I feel, in a sense, fortunate to be watching it and at the same time quite frightened.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us, Roger Morris. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Roger Morris, who served in the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Council under both Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon. His latest book is Comparative History of the Inner Politics of the U.S. and the USSR, Kindred Rivals, America, Russia, and Their Failed Ideals. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about Nicaragua on the brink of calamity. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24-7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Stephen Kinzer, who is an award-winning foreign correspondent. He served as the New York Times bureau chief in Turkey, Germany, and Nicaragua, and as a Boston Globe's Latin American correspondent. He's a senior fellow at the Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs at Brown University, and is the author of All the Shah's Men, Overthrow, and Bitter Fruit. And his latest book is The Brothers, John Foster Dulles, Alan Dulles, and Their Secret World. And he has an article at the Boston Globe, Nicaragua, on the brink of calamity. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Kinzer.
Good to be with you.
And Nicaragua's the ongoing violence, essentially it looks as if the Ortega, the head of the government, has lost the street, lost his own people. And I guess to some extent it's going under the radar because of, you know, for example, everybody's focus is now on a summit in Singapore between President Trump and Kim Jong-un. So do you feel as if this story is not getting the attention it should?
I think you're right. So first of all, just to talk a little bit about what's happening there and then about press coverage, it's remarkable to see what's happened in Nicaragua over these last 2 months because nobody, I think, understood how each little outrage committed by the government over a period of years got people angrier and angrier. No single one was enough to make them explode. And then finally, some very small thing happened, which had to do with changing pension rules, and the whole country exploded. So to me, it's an example of how you really don't know what's going to be the straw that breaks that proverbial camel's back. This is something that's now turned into a national uprising that people didn't even see on the horizon just a couple of months ago. So that's an interesting lesson, including for here in the United States. As for the press coverage, I do think you're right. It's remarkable how little coverage this is getting. I mean, when the Sandinistas and the Contras were fighting a war in the 1980s, that conflict probably drew more international attention than any civil war since the Spanish Civil War of the 1930s. But that was in the shadow of the Cold War, and it shows how little people care about these countries, really. We only cared about countries like Nicaragua when they represented pieces on the global chessboard that we wanted to move. And there's one other thing that I think the coverage question touches on, and it's this. The press is remarkably eager to embrace the narrative that's being promulgated in Washington. It's not so much that the press always has to write what government wants it to write, as much as that the press always writes about subjects that government is focusing on. So essentially the press allows government to set its agenda. The press should actually be setting its own agenda and deciding for itself what stories are important and what needs to be covered. But because Nobody in Congress is really talking about Nicaragua. The president is not talking about it. Members of the cabinet are not talking about it. That sends a message that the news media writes down like a stenographer, which is, oh, Nicaragua is not important, so we got to focus on other places. So I would like to see the press focus a little more on this fascinating and terrifying civic uprising that's going on in a country where the United States has been deeply involved over more than a century.
And again, I'm speaking with Stephen Kinzer, an award-winning foreign correspondent. He served as the New York Times bureau chief in Turkey, Germany, and Nicaragua, and as the Boston Globe's Latin American correspondent. He's a senior fellow at the Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs at Brown University and the author of All the Shah's Men, Overthrow and Bitter Fruit. And his latest book is The Brothers, John Foster Dulles, Alan Dulles, and Their Secret World War. And he has an article at the Boston Globe, Nicaragua on the Brink of Calamity. In your article, Stephen Kinzer, you say that for the second time in many generations, Nicaraguans are rebelling against a decadent family regime. So we all remember the reason why the Sandinista revolution took place to overthrow Somoza. It was largely led by the Ortega brothers. And obviously, Somoza, as FDR famously said, he may be a son of a bitch, but he's our son of a bitch. How do you see that comparison? That's an extraordinary irony, isn't it, that the revolutionary should turn into a despot?
And as you point out, it's not just the revolutionary turning into a despot, which is, after all, a fairly common trope. But it's the family aspect of this dictatorship. So one of the reasons that the Sandinistas gathered power in the late 1970s and finally overthrew the Somoza family dictatorship in 1979 was their taking advantage of national revulsion against the idea that one family should control power, because the Somozas had been in power for more than 40 years, over three different Somoza presidents. So it seemed as though the Sandinistas were coming to power to be the exact opposite of that, to rebel against that, to destroy that idea of how to govern. But in fact, Ortega has now embraced not only despotism, as you point out, but family rule, with his wife being his vice president. All the children are all getting very rich. One of them is being groomed to take over in the next generation. So it leads you to this question. Since he said he was the opposite of this, what happened? And I think maybe part of the answer might be that as Ortega was growing up, that was the period of the Somoza dictatorship. So not having a deeper or wider education, at a certain level, that was the model of political rule that he assimilated. That just seemed to be the default way to govern. And in the back of his mind, consciously or unconsciously, it now seems like there was always this idea to go back to family rule, sort of like in the Godfather style. What he may have forgotten is that it was precisely the family aspect of Somoza rule that brought Somoza down. So that's what makes this seem like Nicaraguans have watched this exact movie before, and it didn't have a good ending the first time either.
So given that there have been, at this point, about 137 people killed, mostly shot by snipers armed with these Dragunov sniper rifles, and they appear to be government-backed paramilitaries, and you've got about 1,000 people wounded. On Thursday, the Catholic bishops met with Ortega, and he left with a rather vague message saying, essentially, I'll think about having new elections, and I'll get back to you in writing. So in terms of this impasse, you've got people taking to the streets, setting up barricades all across the country. You've got these paramilitaries attacking them and shooting them down. I must say, the tactics of shooting people down in the streets, demonstrating, are reminiscent of what Assad did in Syria. And apparently it got so bad that his own forces couldn't do it anymore. And then they brought in the Quds, the Iranian Revolutionary Guards Corps. But it does seem that these assassins are going to keep it up. Is that your sense?
We're at an interesting moment in this conflict. As you pointed out, the Catholic bishops, who had for a while said they didn't even want to talk while the paramilitaries were attacking peaceful demonstrators, did meet with Ortega, and they proposed a calendar whereby there would be elections early next year. And presumably this would mean that the elections would be held without the Ortegas as candidates. So their hope is to devise some kind of a institutional transition. So it isn't just like Somoza where you run out to the airport and jump on a plane. Now, whether Ortega and his increasingly combative wife will accept that way out, which would give them kind of time to arrange their affairs, so to speak, and try to hide what they could and put things in order for their future, or whether they'll be more militant and insist on hanging on to power right up until the end of their current term in 2021 is something we should know very soon. And that could determine the course of this up to now largely peaceful uprising that has been so violently attacked.
So my understanding is that Ortega never got over the fact that after the revolution, he lost the elections in 1990, and he's been out of power for 17 years and then returned to power in 2007. And when you mention his wife, one of the peculiar things about that family was, of course, that his own daughter accused him of molesting her, and the wife stood with her husband against the daughter. What kind of family dynamics are they?
It's a remarkably, almost Shakespearean situation. So, as you point out, the daughter of the now vice president, Ortega's wife, announced some years ago that for a period of about a decade, her stepfather, Daniel Ortega, had been sexually molesting her. And then the mother was put in this spotlight, in this awkward position. So she either has to say, my husband, or at that time they weren't married, but my partner, has been doing this terrible thing to my daughter all these years, so I can't be with him anymore. Or she can say, I don't believe my daughter. She's making it all up. Now, if she had decided to stand up on the side of her daughter, that probably would have brought down the whole Ortega regime, but that would have brought her down with it. So she would have gone back to operating a little bookshop and writing poems, Managua maybe, or trying to find a life somewhere in Miami. On the other hand, if she would only make this one moral compromise and get up and say, my daughter's lying about the whole thing, then not only can Ortega stay in power, but she, by taking this position in defending him, has given herself extraordinary power over him and his ability to stay in power. So that bizarre background, it creates yet another strange overlay that intensifies the anger of Nicaraguans whose explosive frustration we are now witnessing.
And, of course, the elections back in 2006 that brought Ortega to power, he only won 38% of the vote. So the impression you get is that he's never been particularly popular, but it's reached a critical mass, clearly, where people are fed up with him. It's happened, of course. I mentioned Assad. These things happen under these kind of creeping dictatorships. Not that Ortega is anything as ubiquitous as the Assad family rule in terms of their repression, but the Amnesty International are describing what Ortega is doing as a strategy of lethal repression. What is the position with the Inter-American Court of Human Rights and the OAS and other multilateral groups? Are they going to step in to stop this agony? It seems as though the people on the street aren't going to give up in spite of the fact that they're being shot down mercilessly by these government paramilitaries.
The Organization of American States is in very much a part of this process. It's been a little bit reluctant. Part of the problem is that there's so much focus on Venezuela. I think there's also a sense that the Nicaragua situation doesn't seem as urgent in terms of security for the United States. But I do think we're reaching a period of critical mass now in Nicaragua. It's hard to imagine how this situation is going to go back to normal. And when we look back, we can see that at many different points in Nicaraguan history, it has seemed to be on the brink of consolidating some kind of democracy. And Daniel Ortega is the latest incarnation of the frustrations that that democratic process in Nicaragua has had. You know, he established his control over not just the Congress and the Electoral Council, but also the Supreme Court. And when he ran for re-election the first time, he had to confront the little detail that the Constitution forbids re-election very explicitly. So he had his Supreme Court make some decision. He asked them to just come up with some decision that would make it legal for him to run again, even though it says specifically in the Constitution that this is forbidden. And so they did. They came up with a really kind of magic realist decision, saying that that provision in the Constitution that forbids re-election is actually itself unconstitutional, because the Constitution also guarantees equal rights for all Nicaraguan citizens, and not allowing Daniel Ortega to run for another term as president would be violating his equal human rights. And those took precedence over the ban on re-election, so it actually was okay for Ortega to run for re-election. These are the kind of things that over time just get stored in people's minds and feed the later explosion.
Well, you mentioned preoccupation with Venezuela, or at least Venezuela's distracting everybody from what's happening in Nicaragua. There does seem to be a certain similarity there, isn't it, with Maduro hanging on to power, being unpopular, not caring about the will of the people, etc.?
I think there is some kind of a common narrative, and of course these are also both regimes that in their rhetoric proclaim themselves as leftist, even though you could argue about whether that's really true or not. I also think, though, that Venezuela is a country that the United States has had on its radar screen for a long time. It's been very frustrating to the United States that over such a long period, Venezuela has not been a country that's been willing to accept guidance from Washington. So we are eagerly focused on trying to change the situation in Venezuela, and maybe we're not able to do two things at the same time. It reminds me of when I once wrote in a column that the war in Iraq was one of the rare occasions in history where everybody emerged as a loser. Just about every player lost. And somebody wrote me a letter from Latin America and said, no, I said, you're wrong. The Latin America was actually the winner of the Iraq War, because the United States was so preoccupied with Iraq for so many years that popular governments were able to get elected and take power and consolidate reforms in Latin America in a way that we would never have been allowed to do if the United States was still focusing on us. So since the U.S. couldn't do two things at once, they were too busy bombing the Middle East, and that allowed a measure of democracy to flower in Latin America. So I think that might be also in play as you see the imbalance in coverage of what's happening in Venezuela and this most interesting uprising we're now seeing in Nicaragua.
And, of course, you have to add to that that now we have President Trump. He's now essentially starting, well, we're now having a confrontation with our closest neighbor and longest ally, Canada. So that adds to the distraction, I assume. I thank you for joining us, Stephen Kinzer.
Great. Great to be with you. Thanks.
And again, I've been speaking with Stephen Kinzer, who is an award-winning foreign correspondent. He served as the New York Times bureau chief in Turkey, Germany, and Nicaragua, and as a Boston Globe's Latin American correspondent. He's a senior fellow at the Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs at Brown University, and is the author of All the Shah's Men, Overthrow and Bitter Fruit. And his latest book is The Brothers, John Foster Dulles, Alan Dulles, and Their Secret World. And he has an article at the Boston Globe, Nicaragua, On the Brink of Calamity. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Moss. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Alejandra Larivalat. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.